Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
To the Mall and the Park, where we love till 'tis dark. Then sparkling champagne puts an end to their reign. It quickly recovers poor languishing lovers, makes us frolic and gay, and drowns all sorrow. But alas, we relapse again on the morrow. So that, Tom, is Sir George Etheridge's comedy, The Man of Mode, in 1676. And as you will know, that is the first mention of sparkling champagne in all literature. And champagne is very much on our minds, isn't it?
It is.
Both because of where we are and because of when this is going out.
So it's Boxing Day, if you're listening to this when it's come out. And the festive season stretches ahead. We have New Year's Eve, Hogmanay, approaching. And so we thought it would be fun to look at the history of the drinks that we particularly associate with the festive period. And Dominic, as you said, we have come to a special location. So we are not talking at each other down screens, are we? We are literally facing each other.
It's
I'm staring into
actually.
Your gorgeous face.
It's actually, Tom is a lot, he's not as he appears on screens. He's a lot less attractive
beautiful.
In the flesh, I have to say.
Even more beautiful. So we have come to Berry Brothers, which was set up in 1698. I think originally as a kind of general store, and is now...
You were going to say a coffee shop until you were
well,
told off.
That is what the Bodleian told me, but apparently it was a general store. And it's in the heart of St. James's Clubland. So, Dominic, it's just opposite my club.
Your club.
Yeah, which is why I'm here in a suit. But we have a very special guest. And so the reason why, when you read that out, you said that I would have read it too, is because both of us have been reading an absolutely brilliant book on the history of alcohol, which is written by Henry Jeffries. And Henry is with us here in Berry Brothers. In fact, Henry, you suggested this as a location.
Yeah, well, it's the perfect place to talk about the history of booze.
And your book, Empire of Booze, I'll just read a quick couple of sentences from it. The country with the greatest influence on wine and drink in general wasn't France, Germany, or even Australia. It was Britain. Without the British influence, few of our favourite wines would even be in existence. And Dominic, we're a very patriotic podcast,
aren't
we?
We're a people's podcast.
But we're also very much a British podcast. And so it's absolutely brilliant, Henry, that you have given us the excuse to talk about the history of alcohol and focus it very much on Britain. So could just begin. Dominic mentioned champagne as perhaps the kind of paradigmatic drink that people at Christmas use to toast the festive season. In what possible way could champagne be considered a British drink, bearing in mind that champagne is in France?
Yes, no, it's a bit of a leap, isn't it? But in order to keep bubbles in a bottle, you need a very strong bottle because the pressure is huge. And bottles previously would have been like a decanter. So they would break very, very easily. They were very fragile. But in 1630, a scientist, a polymath, a rogue called Sir Kenelm Digby probably invented a strong glass bottle. And we don't really need to go into detail about how he did
that.
We're
not a glass making podcast.
No, we are a podcast that's done the gunpowder plot, however. And so he was the son of one of the conspirators, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. His father was a Catholic conspirator. So he was sort of disgraced during the Civil War time. So he had this sort of wonderful career traveling around Europe. I think he was propositioned by Marie de Medici, or so he claimed in his memoirs. But he was also a scientist and used to correspond with Galileo and, you know, all the kind of big names at the time. And he was a founder member of the Royal Society. And he experimented with glass. And one of the things that he did was come up with a new type of furnace that could make glass much, much stronger. So he invented. So when we think of a bottle, which is something quite strong that can hold wine or whatever you want in it, we have Sir Kenelm Digby to thank for that. And then so he and other scientists at the time were experimenting with making things fizz. So if you think of wine, when it ferments, it fizzes and all the carbon dioxide sort of dissipates. But if you can control that fermentation in a strong bottle and cork it, then the carbon dioxide gets dissolved into the liquid. And then you open it, voila, something very similar to champagne.
So before Cam Digby, and he develops this, wines were not fizzy.
Well, wines would have been accidentally fizzy.
So that would have been kind of spoiled.
It would have been considered a fault. So if your barrel of champagne, which would have been a wine at the time.
So it's a wooden barrel.
Not a wooden barrel, we would turn up and it might still be fermenting, and then it might have been shipped when it was very, very cold. It would stop fermenting, and then it might warm up in sort of March, April, and it would start fermenting again. So there would be a slight fizz, what the French call pétillon, but a proper bubbles like champagne, you wouldn't have been able to do that.
So the French, if they were listening to, I mean, obviously we did once have millions of French listeners, but we've driven them away with our francophobia. But they would say Dom Perignon, when they invented fizz in champagne, isn't that their claim?
Yes.
But you don't believe that's true?
It's a complete myth. It was something invented by Moët et Chandon as a marketing tool. He did make champagne.
So when is Dom Perignon? He's after Kenan Digby.
Is he 18th century.
Okay, so Johnny come lately.
He was a bit of a Johnny, but he would have made champagne, and he was very important in the history of champagne. He isolated grape varieties, sort of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and made very good wine, apparently. But he would have not wanted fizz. That would have been a fault to him.
Oh, right.
And all the stuff about icy stars is a 19th century invention.
So the fizz, are we responsible for the fizz as well, the British?
We are responsible for applying scientific rigor to making things fizzy. Before, it would have been a very haphazard event.
Yeah.
And in fact, over here, it was mainly cider makers who were doing it. So there were all these early members of the Royal Society who were West Country cider makers.
I love that. Like, I love them getting kind of trashed on cider in the Royal Academy.
Exactly.
It's so unexpected.
And giving papers to the Royal Academy about sparkling cider whilst off their heads on 10% cider. So there was a very brief flowering in England of wine-style ciders. So this was due to a kind of war with the French. And the idea was that cider would replace imported wine. So it was a very kind of, you know, we don't need the French anymore because we've got cider. But it never really took off. So these kind of proto-champagne ciders died out. But the technology then crossed the channel and the French started doing it. And then, you know, I hate to say it, but they actually did it better.
Oh, that's
and
a shame.
And they turned it into a process. They turned it into a sort of semi-industrial process.
But the British remain kind of obsessed by champagne. We've always been the largest market for champagne?
Until very recently, we were the largest export market for champagne. And it was created for British tastes. So at one point, champagne would have been sweet, and it would have been for the Russian court, who liked everything very, very sweet. And then with the sort of rise of the middle class in England in the sort of 19th century, a taste for these gastronomic champagnes, ones that you would have with food, brut, dry champagne, that was created for the English market.
And is that in your book? I mean, you start with champagne, don't you, as we've started the podcast. And it is sort of symbolic of the general trend, because you talk about, I mean, the argument is that Britain affects the booze trade because Britain is the great consumer, I guess. You have this wonderful line that, you know, a British wine merchant had access to more varieties of wine than the King of France did. Because in France, people just drank locally.
They just drank. In fact, the French king would have probably not have had Bordeaux, because Bordeaux was on a road that would have taken, it would have taken weeks to get from Bordeaux to Paris, but from Bordeaux to London would have taken days. So it was, and London was the wealthiest city in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, so Britain serves as wine merchant to the world. And so in a way, it's a little bit like sport, perhaps, that Britain, you know, the British economy and British global reach enables Britain to set standards and to kind of export its tastes around the world, so that these drinks, I had no idea, had been shaped by British taste quite to the degree that they are.
Yeah, well, these create the paradigms. So sort of champagne, sparkling wine, claret, port, and they are imitated all over the world.
Just one last question about champagne before we move on. You talk in the chapter about champagne's prestige, about the status and therefore the high cost level. Is champagne so expensive and so prestigious merely because we think it's prestigious. In other words, is it merely a meaning that we attribute to the drink and therefore its value, rather than it being particularly expensive to produce or particularly rare or any of those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It is more expensive to produce. The method for making the wine fizzy, where you make a wine, you put it in a bottle, you add sugar, you cork it, and then you have to leave it for 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. So that's a very capital intensive process. And then you do a thing where you open the bottle, you let the yeast out. So there's a sort of expensive industrial process, which requires a huge amount of capital. But once these companies are set up, then I don't think, you know, it is a bit more expensive per bottle to make than a still wine, but not that much more. So it is then so much about prestige and marketing
because,
and stuff.
Yeah, because Henry, you make the general point that the intrinsic quality of the wine often is less important than the ability to ship it to Britain. So you mentioned Bordeaux as a kind of classic example. And I suppose another a wine that is particularly associated with the festive period is claret, which comes from Bordeaux. And this takes us back beyond the 17th century, back to the Middle Ages, because in the Middle Ages, Bordeaux was often directly under English rule. So is this a process that is reaching right the way back to the Middle Ages?
Oh, right. Yeah. Right back to the Middle Ages. Bordeaux, though, medieval Bordeaux would have been very different to Bordeaux that came later. It would have been very pale in colour. It would have been more like a very dark rosé.
The thin potations Shakespeare talks about.
Yes. So claret is claret, which means a sort of, you can still buy it in Bordeaux. It's a dark rosé. So it would have been like a sort of plonk, you know, it would have been shipped over and then you drank it as quickly as possible because it would have turned to vinegar.
Right.
In about 6 months. So claret became the claret we know in the 17th century. It became a sort of totally different.
And is that because of Kenelm Digby's bottles?
I think partly to do with the bottles, but it would have been shipped in cask. So it could have been bottled in London, but most of the time it would have been sold in cask. And there was a chap called Arnaud de Pontac from Chateau Aubryon, which is a very famous Bordeaux chateau. And he created this new kind of wine that would sell for two or three times the price of normal wine in London. So it would be made from very ripe grapes. He'd have treated them very, very carefully, only picked, because previously all the grapes would have gone in to make this sort of rosé wine. And he just picked the best of black ones to make this very dark wine, aged in new barrels, be sent over to London. And this is what Pepys tried when he said it hath a very particular taste.
But again, is this partly, it's not just about the quality of the wine, is it also about the marketing?
I mean, it would have been a much, much more expensive wine to make because he would have discarded grapes. He would have only used the best ones to make something not dissimilar to modern day Bordeaux. But yes, it was the marketing. It was also, they set up a tavern in the city of London. You know, it would have all been about reaching the rich customers of London.
So is it 17th century, are we saying, when claret as we know it basically originated? 17th, 18th century?
Yeah, it would have been sort of Restoration London, right, sort of time.
So it's all Restoration London. It's all kind of massive lads getting drunk on champagne and claret and stuff.
It would have been a wonderful time to be alive. You know, if the dentistry was better, it would have been.
Yeah, and you didn't own a shop in the middle of the city of London, obviously. That would be bad.
But with Bordeaux, it's an interesting one because you have wine, you have the merchants in the city. Is that right? The people actually in the city who are often British or they're English speaking.
Yeah.
And then you have the producers in the, you know, in the countryside who are French. Now, with champagne, which we already talked about, a lot of the names are German.
Yes, so yes.
Heidsieck and so on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So with Bordeaux, why is it that it didn't then go the way of Portugal, where, you know, you buy a bottle of Coburn's or Graham's or whatever? Why don't you buy a bottle of Graham's from Bordeaux? Why did the merchants? Because the merchants must have lost control, did they, at some point?
Yes, well, I wouldn't say they lost control, because a lot of them controlled the trade right up until the 1970s. You had like Nathaniel Johnston, you had the Bartons and stuff. But the names of the chateau became sort of brand names. So you'd have, you know, if you were a prosperous lawyer in 18th, 19th century Bordeaux, the Médoc, which is the famous bit where
most of the wines come from.
That's the left bank.
Left bank, yes. Yeah, just north of the city. And that had been drained by Dutch merchants, Dutch engineers in the 18th century. So it's very flat and sort of gravelly and not very pretty. And you would have these all this speculative vine planting by these lawyers with a bit of money. And then they would build these ridiculous fairy tale chateaux as a way of saying, you know,
like the ones on the Loire, but like totally the Loire, bogus.
But totally yep. bogus. You yep. know, almost like the ones you get in China these days.
Yeah.
And these became brands. So you had, you know, you had Latour and stuff are older, but like Pichon, Longueville, that sort of stuff. The pictures of the chateau became famous. Whereas in Burgundy, for example, if you look at old bottles here, they'll just say, for Burgundy, they'll just say Beaune, you know, just the name of the where it comes from. Whereas with the claret, it's got the name of the chateau. So the chateau.
When you say old bottles, you don't mean the kind of old bottles that Tom and I would buy.
to throw out.
Yeah. Well, they've got sort of 19th century bottles here at Berry Brothers. And the Bordeaux ones have the name of a specific chateau on.
Right.
Whereas the Burgundy ones just have the name of where it comes from. Region. And then it would have been the merchant would have bought the wine and marketed it. So even though the merchants were very powerful in Bordeaux and used to do all kinds of weird stuff to the wine, so they would ship it in barrel and then they would beef it up with port and brandy and stuff for London tastes because the English were thought not to have very subtle tastes. It would then be sold by the brand name of the chateau.
So just on the English tastes, since you mentioned that. So with champagne, you said that the English basically dictated the dryness of it, which is actually quite counter to our general instinct, which seems to have been British liked things very sweet and very. So in other words, presumably people looked on the British in the 18th and 19th century, much as we in the old world now look at Americans with regard to their.
That's exactly
it. They like everything overflavored, massively sugary, too strong. And so they've lost all kind of subtlety. I mean, is that true generally of British taste, would you say, in the early history of booze?
Yes. No, I would say that's entirely true. They used to make sherry and stuff. They would just fill it full of sweet wines and things. And they thought that's what they like in cold climates. But also there were connoisseurs as well. There were people who were, there was a fashion for dry champagne. So which sort of superseded the more robust tastes that other English people were.
And Henry, on the topic of fashion, the other fascinating thing that I learned was that the taste for claret has a political dimension.
It does, yes, yes. No, it's it was traditionally wine would have come from France, and the Stuarts were aligned with the French. And then when they were deposed, you know, the Glorious Revolution, William III and stuff, it became much harder to get hold of claret. There's lots of duty put on claret. And there's other things like war with the Dutch as well, who shipped a lot of wine from Bordeaux. So people went to Portugal instead, oldest ally, you know, all that kind of stuff for the wine. So people who supported the Hanoverians, you know, the sort of people who came after William III would have enthusiastically drunk port. Whereas the people, the Jacobites.
Yeah. King over the water.
Yeah, the king over the water who pined for the Stuart king would drink claret. And the Scots, you know, would in particular would drink claret as a way.
I didn't
know
the Scots down as claret drinkers, did you?
No, I didn't either.
Well,
but
it's good to know. They have their old alliance. You know?
Yes, of course they do. Yes, of course they do.
And it was a way of saying, you know, we don't believe in the Hanoverians. We want the Stuarts back. So we're going to drink claret.
So if you've got a bottle of claret, you're a Tory. And if you've got a bottle of port, then you're a Whig. And Dominic,
yes,
ironically,
yeah.
You're a huge enthusiast for port, aren't you?
I like port.
You've done two episodes. So we did one on the Methuen Treaty, which just remind us what the Methuen Treaty is.
So the Methuen Treaty is, I think, 1703, isn't it, Henry? John Methuen, he goes to Portugal and they negotiate a treaty. And the deal basically is, so this is during, I mean, I think at the time it's the War of the Spanish Succession. I should say, actually, Tom, we are actually drinking port right now.
Yeah,
so if you're wondering,
very nice Graham's 30-year-old.
Yes, courtesy of Henry, very generously.
Well, courtesy of Graham's.
So if the standard of questioning,
I was about to say,
disintegrates over the slips over the course of the program, you'll know why.
So yes, the War of the Spanish Succession, constant sort of trade blockages and embargoes and things with the French. Portugal, as Henry, as you said, is our oldest ally. We did four episodes on Portugal. And then we did another, we've actually done five episodes on Portugal this year, Tom.
Yeah.
But the Methuen Treaty, I think, as I remember, The deal was that they would be, the duty would be a third less on Portuguese wines than it would be.
And for, so it massively boosted
the Portuguese wine trade.
Yeah,
exactly. So I love the story of ports because it's one in which history is so obviously uppermost.
You know, so, and so you mentioned the British merchants who settle.
Yeah.
In northern Portugal. And Dominic Henry, in his book, The Empire of Booze, has this comment. The British didn't mix with the Portuguese and were mocked for their terrible grasp of the local language, which even the Portuguese admit is extremely hard to pronounce.
Well, Tom.
So
you're saying that to make excuses for your own very poor
Well, they
Portuguese.
Have a term for us, Bebado English, which means English drunk.
English drunk.
Yeah.
Well, nobody gets English drunk in this podcast.
And Dominic, there's more. Did you see... this chap, John Mitton, talking of English drunks.
Did you see
about him?
Jack Mitton. Don Shropshire. Mitton.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know all about him.
Okay, so the prize for
He's rowdiest... A like me.
The prize for rowdiest port drinker goes to a Shropshire squire called John Mitton.
I know him well.
Who drank between 4 and 6 bottles for most of his adult life. He once set fire to his nightshirt in order to cure hiccups.
He rode a bear.
Is this standard behaviour in Shropshire?
Isn't he? Yeah, he did.
He
rode a bear and he took, when he went to either Oxford or Cambridge, he took 2,000 bottles of port with him.
Yeah, and he didn't take a degree and he didn't, and he left all his wine.
He drank all his wine.
So
a role model,
a role model. A great man and a great representative
a great Shropshire
of
man.
Shropshire. Better, I would say, than Charles Darwin, Tom, who you bored everybody with a few weeks ago. So, Henry, listen, let's talk about port. Portuguese wine, I learned to my horror from your book, was regarded as a bit rustic and a bit rubbish until what, the 18th century? Or even then was it regarded as a little bit downmarket?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem was is a lot of the stuff that was coming over to England would have been quite similar to, well, it would have been from the Vino Verde region, where, you know, you must have had Vino Verde, very light, delicious white wine.
Yeah.
They also make a red wine, which isn't quite so delicious.
It's a bit too light for me, Vino Verde, if I'm completely honest with you.
You're a port drinker, you know?
Yeah.
A wig.
And it would have been transported in goat skins or pig skins or something. And it wasn't, you know, it was a local wine. It shouldn't really have been shipped. And it would arrive in England and it wouldn't be very nice. And sometimes they would beef it up with brandy, which probably made it even worse. So something like what we think of as port is this sort of beautifully smooth, rich, didn't really exist yet. And it was only when they started going up country where it was much, much hotter and the grapes would get much riper. Then they would come back and they would buy the wine from the local growers, but it would be in a much stronger, more stable wine,
the Douro
Valley. So even if you have a table wine from the Douro, it's 14-15%, you know, thick wine.
Henry, what I also learned from your book was that is it the Marquis de Pombal?
Oh,
I think he's a bit of a friend of the show.
He's a friend of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very robust in his
He's
approach.
Very robust. Yeah. He rebuilt Lisbon after the earthquake.
Yeah. So 18th century.
Bicher, very nice.
Yeah. He's kind of the power behind the throne in the mid 18th century. And that he is the person who demarcates the boundaries of the port growing region. And that the French didn't do that with their, you know, their wine regions until the 1930s.
He also forbade the planting of elderflower bushes because the elderberries would be used to beef up the colour of the wine, which was not good. So you weren't allowed to plant on pain of death.
So a fine political leader.
No, he was a great man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very wise, very sage.
So the port lodges are all still there. They're English names, aren't they? Sandeman's, Taylor's.
So Sandeman logo, he wears a Portuguese student's cloak and a Spanish sombrero.
Yes. That's sort of the Don, is it?
That's the Don, yeah.
The Don.
There is a George Sandeman who I've met, who is very, very charming, speaks Spanish, English, Portuguese, but the company's now owned by a Portuguese company, so it's not a family business anymore.
But are there any of, so those houses, they're what, 18th century, some of those?
Are there
any of them still in the family?
Taylor's still has family members, Taylor, Fladgate, Yateman, there are still family members there. Graham's is now owned by the Symington family, who are considered the Johnny-come-latelys of
the They're British.
They're British, yeah. They came over in the 19th century.
Oh God. It's a parvenus.
But they bought Graham's in 1970, and they are sort of a force in the industry.
Right.
Right. So I think we should take a break at this point, charge our glasses, and then when we come back, we should look at the other kind of classic British-influenced Hispanic Christmas drink, which is sherry. So we'll be back with sherry.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest Is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
If I had 1,000 sons, the first human principle I would teach them should be to forswear thin potations and to addict themselves to sack. That is Sir John Falstaff in Shakespeare's Henry IV plays. And we've already mentioned, Henry, that thin potations to Shakespeare would have been the wines from Bordeaux. The sack, which Falstaff goes on and on and on about, is the drink that we call sherry. Is that right?
Yes, largely. It's almost like Shakespeare was being sponsored by the sack marketing board, isn't it? Because it's easily the most mentioned drink in his plays.
Does that have something to do with the fact that, again, as I learned from your book, that Francis Drake sacked Cadiz, and as it were, and took away 1 million barrels of sherry?
I think that
seems a lot.
It's a true story, but I think it was already a very popular drink, and I think that probably just made it even more popular. But I think at one point London was awash with stolen sherry. But sack wouldn't have just been sherry. Sack was a sort of generic term for wine, so you'd have Canary sack from the Canary Islands. So it would have just been a sort of strong, sweet wine from Spain, really. So it could have come from a variety of places. Could be from Jerez, could be from Canary Islands,
but
Malaga.
That's where the name comes from, is it?
Yeah.
Well, sherry comes from Jerez. Sac probably comes from sacar, meaning to draw out in Spanish, but no one is quite sure where the word comes from.
So people were drinking an ancestor of sherry in the, so Shakespeare's time, so we're talking the late 16th, early 17th century, but is it what we would call sherry? It's not yet. Is it fortified? No.
It wouldn't have been fortified, and it would have been young as well. So sherry, as we know it, comes from aging wine for a long time and blending it in a thing called a Solera system. So you have this aged, consistent product. This would have just been wine that would have been from a vintage, would have been sweetened probably with raisined wine, so dried berry wine.
So you can say that it's sherry simply because it comes from that region. It's purely on the based on the region.
It's not what we would think of as sherry. It would have been a sort of a mixture of various wines from that part of the world.
So when does it start to become what we would recognize as sherry?
Probably in the 18th century when they start blending between vintages. So people start, apparently it's to do with, I can't remember which war it is, but there are lots of stocks that just sit there in Jerez and don't get sold. And then when they are sold, people get a taste for these old wines. And so in order to, obviously there's a finite supply. So they start blending the young wines with the old wines. And gradually that becomes a systematic thing.
They have a
thing called a Solera, which is
the barrels.
A pyramid of barrels is the best way to think about it. Young wine at the top, old wine at the bottom. You take off from the bottom, you add to the top, so that the wine you take off is a mixture of old and young wines, some of them very, very old.
And the people who are doing this are British or Spanish, or who's doing it? And in correspondence to whose tastes, Spanish or British tastes?
Well, it wouldn't just be English taste or British taste. It would also be American tastes, French tastes, because sherry was sort of, you know, pretty big all over the place. Most of the merchants were actually Spanish, or there were some French ones. The Domecq, one of the big names, was French. Lustau, another one, was French. Most of them, there weren't that many English ones, apart from there's Gonzalez Bias, and then there's who's... Oh, no, there were some English ones. Osborne, which is when you see those bulls dotted around, that's Osborne.
On the Spanish landscape.
But they've been there so long that they'd become Hispanophiled, if you will. So they were Osborne. So that's the thing, is that in Jerez, they went native, right, in a way that they didn't
in Portugal.
In Porto.
So something that they have in common... Well, I had always imagined before reading your book that the fortification, so the adding of, I don't know, brandy, let's say.
Brandy, yeah.
Was because of transport. So I had sort of read somewhere a few years ago, oh, because of the War of the Spanish Succession, blah, 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 people added, they fortified Portuguese wine and they invented port for the British. And I thought, oh, what a tremendous fact. But it sounds like from the examples of sherry and port that you give that the fortification is actually not to do with the transport or anything like that. It's to do with our debased, vulgarized...
Yes, our vulgar tastes.
Our vulgar tastes. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard to know exactly when and why fortification became routine. People say it's to make a product that can travel, but then a wine, if it's well-made and strong enough, will travel without fortification. Right. There's no need to fortify. People think, if you sort of jumping ahead to Madeira, there are letters from English merchants saying, send some more of that strong stuff. So apparently in due to the various wars, people started distilling wine because they had too much of it. So you had brandy that they didn't really know what to do with. So they started sticking it, you know, beefing up the wine.
Yeah. I have a theory which goes back to a podcast that went out a few weeks ago, because we did a podcast about roast beef, didn't we, Tom?
We did, yes.
And there was always this sort of sense in the 18th century that English cooking was more robust and more simple. You know, it was kind of...
honest.
But it was sort of, you'd have your roast beef, but you'd have very, very strong mustard or horseradish with it, much stronger than the... much more pungent than the more complicated, sophisticated sauces that they had in France or Italy. And I'm wondering whether people wanted very sort of robust, earthy, rich, big drinks.
You're saying sherry is John Bull, John I'm Bull's tipple?
Yes, I'm saying if you drink port or sherry now, you can pat yourself on the back and say, beef and liberty,
you're a true, you know, born Englishman.
Dr. Johnson.
Yes.
All this sort of, which I do all the time anyway, actually.
I need you.
Is that
possible? There might be something in that. And also you could sort of link it with the way that English people took to Indian food so much, because it was just, we like big, punchy, spicy flavours.
Yeah.
I mean, you say that by the middle of the 19th century, roughly 40% of the wine drunk in Britain is sherry. And is that sherry as we would recognise it now?
That would have been not dissimilar to your sort of Harvey's Bristol Cream.
So what proportion are they drinking it? I mean...
They would have drunk it just sort of neat. They would have had it, you know, like a, you know, you'd go to someone's house and rather than tea or coffee, you might just be offered
because
a
today,
glass
I mean,
of sherry.
You kind of have a, oh, have a sherry, little cheeky sherry, and then you move
Tom,
on to something else.
Do you have a cheeky Harvey's Bristol cream every now and again?
No, I have a dry sherry. I have a Fino.
A Fino, yeah.
And what's the one that tastes like Christmas pudding?
Pedro Jimenez?
Yeah, Pedro Jimenez. That's I mean, that's a Patriots drink, isn't it?
I like Pedro Jimenez, but yeah. Henry's just laughing and not showing the respect that I think.
No, because
do you like Pedro Jimenez, Henry, or do you think?
I find it quite hard to drink, but in very small doses. But
yeah, because in small doses, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you might have one. I mean, you had two, but you wouldn't have more than two. But you're saying that in the Victorian period, they're just knocking it back. Bring me another bottle of Pedro Jimenez.
Well, it would have been had a tiny bit of Pedro Jimenez in it. So it would have been.
So it wouldn't be this thick and
it would have been a
blended
sherry with a little bit of very sweet sherry in, and you would have a decanter. And just when people came over, you would offer them a glass of sherry.
I can imagine Dickens drinking a lot of that.
Dickens is a sherry man. I've never thought of Dickens.
He liked
a sherry
cobbler. So he liked cocktails made from sherry
cobbler.
So just on boozing. So we've talked before about William Pitt, the younger, great friend of the rest of his history.
Yeah.
Great foe of Napoleonic France and of the Jacobinism.
Great one for rolling maps up.
So we were very impressed by him as a three-bottle man, weren't we, Tom?
Yeah.
A man who drank three bottles of wine. But the bottles were generally smaller.
They probably would have been imperial pint bottles.
So they're like a pint of milk.
Pint of milk, but stronger, you know, full of alcohol. Well, alcoholic milk.
Right.
But they probably wouldn't have been 20% like normal port. They would probably been, they may not have been fortified at all. So they might have been 15% dry wine.
And
a
so,
pint, you know, like having a pint of Australian Shiraz, perhaps.
So Henry,
three pints of those.
Also, I mean, a contemporary of Pitt's, William Wilberforce, and you say that he, you know, he has this, he's a massive lad, hanging out with all the lads, all that kind of thing. And then he has this evangelical conversion and decides he's going to go off and abolish slavery. And the marker of his kind of this pledge is that he's going to be abstemious. And he writes in his journal, from now on, I'm only going to drink 6 glasses of wine a day.
Yeah, it's so brilliant.
Very abstemious.
And it sounds hilarious to us that this is kind of,
how big are the glasses?
The sobriety. How big is the glass? I mean, how abstemious is he being in only having 6 glasses a day?
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it? But when you look at the glasses, when you look at vintage port glasses, they're quite little. You know, you think of Master and Commander, and they're toasting and stuff. They would have been quite. So actually, that's quite abstemious, I think, if we assume that he was having little glasses of port. Yeah, that's quite healthy.
And the glasses of sherry that people are having in the Victorian period? So I think of the Victorians as quite abstemious generally.
No, I don't.
Don't you?
No, I think they were having sherry cobblers and blind man's buff and all that. I mean, only if you're Scrooge in your counting house.
No, I think they drank.
But if you're off with Mr. Fezziwig.
Because they used to drink just small beer. If you lived in London, that would have been, rather than water, you'd have had, you know, 3% beer. That would have just been the sort of normal thing. So beer wasn't even thought of as alcoholic.
But they're not knocking back the gin like their 18th century predecessors.
I think there was a lot of gin drink. Because all those amazing gin palaces around London were all built by gin
companies. We mustn't talk about gin because I think we should save that for an entirely separate episode because it's such a fascinating story. But Henry, alcohol that hasn't kind of made it through, that has gone, you know, fallen by the wayside. And I guess the one that you cite as the classic example is masala, which was apparently Nelson's favourite tipple.
It was, yeah.
But I don't think I've ever drunk. Have you drunk?
I'm confused whether that's the same as Malmsey. Is it?
No, Malmsey is a type of Madeira. It's one made from Malvasia, grape. Masala was originally created as a sort of Madeira substitute because Madeira was so popular that people used to make South African Madeira or Cyprus Madeira. And masala was originally sold as, there was a brand called Bronte Madeira, which is Nelson's
title that
Nelson's
he gets given, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us exactly what masala wine is and what the link is to Nelson and how and why it hasn't made it through to the present day, really.
Well, masala was a type of wine that apparently dates back to Roman times called vino perpetuo, everlasting wine. And it would be in these huge barrels called botti, probably terrible Italian pronunciation there, and they would just be topped up. So if you were a farmer, you'd have this sort of thing. And it was a very, very strong wine that lasted, and that's what the English liked. And you had a merchant called John Woodhouse from Liverpool, and he came to Masala to trade. It may have been wine, may have been in something else. And he tried the wine and thought, I can sell this as Madeira. This is the stuff. So he started buying it, and then he would subject it to a bit of kind of tarting up for the English market. He'd add grape must, you know, to sweeten it so it was more to English tastes. And then Nelson, who was hanging around in the Bay of Naples
with Lady Hamilton,
getting up to all sorts.
Yeah.
And he visited and he tried the wine and became quite good friends with Woodhouse. And he loved the wine and said that it should be supplied by the Royal Navy, supplied to the Royal Navy for officers. So he started buying wine from Woodhouse. Well, the Royal Navy started buying from Woodhouse. And it became the drink that was what officers drank in the Navy. And it was just a sort of strong Madeira or sherry style sweet wine. And then other English merchants came out. There was a sort of Ingham's and Whittaker's and stuff. And there was this sort of brief golden age, like sort of Dallas or something, but of wine in Palermo in the 19th century. And they had balls, and it was like the leopard, and they all, they had these huge palazzos. And if you go to Marsala today, there's only one producer left now in Marsala, on the front, Florio, who was Italian from Calabria. But you see the ruined Ingham and Woodhouse balios.
And they are
massive.
Yeah.
And it's like 2 miles of harbour.
How sad.
With these ruined Marsala, essentially Marsala warehouses.
But what went wrong? Why has sherry lasted and port and Madeira has lasted, actually, hasn't it?
But just about. It was because there was a race to the bottom. So the wines sort of went a bit out of fashion.
Hmm.
Whereas sherry and Madeira managed to keep their quality levels up, even though that sales were declining. Harvey's Bristol Cream, you might mock it, but it's a pretty solid product. Whereas in Marsala, they started doing ones that were mixed with eggs or flavored with almonds or vanilla.
Yeah.
And it became something that people just used for cooking. So there's lots of Italian-American dishes.
So is it possible, is anyone making Marsala of the kind that Nelson would have drunk? I mean, is it possible to experience what Nelson drunk?
It is, yes. Now, I was very fortunate enough to stay at a hotel owned by a sort of Marsala historian who goes around buying up rare casks of Marsala. And he has them all in his cellar. And he took me down there and gave me some to try. And these would have been a taste of the wines as they would have been before they were, sweetened up for the British market.
Did it fill you with a zeal for king and country after you'd drunk it?
They were certainly wonderful wines. I wouldn't quite say a zeal.
Have a yearning to go to sea.
So on the issue of old wines, how far back can we drink wine and think that we're drinking what people drank at the time? So in other words, there must be wines around from, I don't know, mid 19th century or something. If I were to open one now and drink it, could I reasonably say, oh, I'm drinking what Dickens would have tasted, let's say? Or would it have changed so much in the interim that it wouldn't be remotely what Dickens would have tasted?
I mean, the only wine that would last that long, there's a few, but Madeira is the one. And Berry Brothers, I think they still sell a lot of very, very old Madeiras dating back to the 19th century.
God, I'm quite tempted to buy one.
They're not as expensive as you think.
So how
expensive? It's sort of £500 a bottle.
Oh, God, that is expensive. Okay.
But considering some of them are sort of 150 years old.
But Henry, I should mention at this point that in your book, you offer wines that you can buy that are not extortionate, that correspond to how you think various drinks would have tasted. And I've actually, I bought some of your recommendations. I bought two of your recommendations in the sherry chapter for Sadie, my wife. And so this is going out on Boxing Day. So by this time, dear listeners, we will know whether Sadie enjoyed her present.
So you're saying Lestau, if you buy Lestau sherry.
Well, Lestau, old East India sherry is meant to be a recreation of a sweet style of sherry that would have traveled around the world on East India men. And the thing about sherry, and particularly Madeira, is that they were very, very robust. And when they went through the tropics, when it got very hot, most wines would be, absolutely ruined. But certain types of sherry, and in particular Madeira, actually improved. And one of the sherries was Lestau Old India.
And by and large, just before we move on, have our tastes, if we went back in time, if the three of us journeyed back to 1850 or 1750.
What fun that would be.
What fun that would be indeed. But would the wine, or the alcohol generally, be much sweeter than we're used to now, do you think?
It would be sweeter and it would be less fresh, because all the sort of, when we drink wine, we're used to having those wonderful fresh berry flavours like you get with a Sauvignon Blanc or a Pinot Grigio, which almost all owe all the flavors to temperature controlled fermentation. So if you can keep the temperature down when the wine is fermenting, you get all those fruit flavors. But in the old days, you didn't have that. So in Spain and Portugal and stuff, it would get very hot when it fermented. So you wouldn't get those pure fruit flavors. And people didn't understand quite as well as we do what oxygen does to a wine. So what the wines would all be slightly oxidized.
Right.
Well, not all of them, but your sherries, Madeiras and stuff. So the wines would be sort of nuttier and less fresh.
So, Henry, one last drink, because we've been mainly talking about kind of festive Christmassy drinks, but of course we've got New Year's Eve coming up, and the paradigmatic drink, particularly if you're in Scotland, that you drink New Year's Eve is whiskey. Except Dominic is pulling a face.
Do people drink whiskey on New Year's Eve? Do you drink whiskey on New Year's Eve, Henry?
No. Yes.
Yes, people do. Tom is making this claim, and I just
know it's true. I have always drunk whiskey on New Year's Eve.
Have you?
I thought that was a thing.
You're maybe not the norm.
Well, maybe I'm not, but it's my custom. And right, it's half podcast, my podcast. It's half your podcast. Half my podcast, so I'm going to insist on it. So, Henry, whiskey, all the other drinks we've been talking about have come from the sun-kissed Mediterranean. Whiskey very much doesn't. Where does it come from? How come it gets made? How does it end up becoming as popular as it has done?
Yeah, it's less different to the other ones than it might at first seem, because all the other ones were created for basically English tastes, and whiskey as we know it until very recently was created for English tastes.
Not Scottish tastes. English, not British.
No. The Scots were making whiskey for an awful long time, but it was something that stayed in Scotland. Most of it would be made illegally. You had these malt whiskies. They would be very different to what we know as whiskey today. They'd be very strongly flavoured, but they wouldn't have been aged. So they would have been almost like a sort of very strongly flavoured vodka. They'd be like a sort of moonshine. And they've generally stayed in Scotland. And occasionally English people would go north of the border and they would try them. And they would.
Well, you have this brilliant description of that. In the literature of the Georgian and early Victorian period, it's apparent that drinking whiskey while in Scotland was the modern day equivalent of licking hallucinogenic toads while in the Amazon. I mean, how our Scottish listeners will react to three Englishmen chortling at that, I don't know.
They can't get enough of that.
I'm going to be in trouble for this one. But so it was not something that really left Scotland or even left the Highlands, these sort of proto-malt whiskies.
Right, because Burns describes lowland whiskey as the most rascally liquor.
Which it was an industrial product.
Yeah.
And, you know, English people did try them and they did come south a bit. But it was merchants in Glasgow, Aberdeen, Kilmarnock, like Shivers Brothers, Johnny Walker.
So who's Johnny Walker? Is he a bloke?
Walker of Kilmarnock. He was a shopkeeper, tea merchant. Wow. And coffee. So not dissimilar to Berry Brothers.
Right.
And so what they would do is they would buy Highland whiskies, which were the high quality ones, and they would buy Lowland whiskies, which were the lighter, not so good quality ones. And they also sold port, Madeira, rum. So they would have loads of barrels lying around. So they would store it in these barrels. And it was discovered that the thyme and the leftover wine in the barrels turned this sort of quite, you know, this colourless liquid, which had a lot of flavour but wasn't particularly sophisticated, into something sublime. And then they would create a consistent product, which they would market under brand name, like John Walker, Bell's, Shivers Brothers. But south of the border in England, they drank brandy, they drank cognac, and that's what you would have when you were at your gentleman's club. You'd have a brandy and soda or just a neat brandy. But then there was phylloxera, which was an aphid.
Yes, which is always wiping out the vines, isn't
exactly,
it, in Bordeaux and so
destroyed
on.
Destroyed the vines in cognac, and there was no cognac to be had. So there was a sort of panic in the gentlemen's clubs of St. James's. So the sort of canny Scots merchants decided they were going to create blends for the London market. So the Scottish blends would have been, you know, robust, powerful, peaty whiskies that were often drunk with honey in sort of toddies. Whereas the English, they wanted lighter whiskies that they could mix with soda for drinking in their gentlemen's clubs. So the Scottish merchants created whiskies for the London market, which were close in flavour profile to cognac.
Crikey. So soda, you'd have whiskey and soda. That's, I mean, people do drink whiskey and soda or brandy and soda, don't they?
My grandmother's favourite drink.
But soda has gone out of, completely gone out of fashion, hasn't it?
They're trying to bring it back. So they now call them highballs, and
right.
the bar keeping fraternity
and
are trying to bring them back.
I mean, Henry, Scottish whiskey is seen as kind of the brand leader. It's the champagne of whiskies. Would that be, I mean, that's my perspective.
I would say that's, you know, and especially to do with the marketing as well, because the champagne has been so brilliantly marketed, yeah. And the and same so with Scotch whiskey.
So it's seen as part of that kind of Celts, Brigadoon, you know, all that kind of stuff, the kind of comedy Scottishness.
That sort of Walter Scott.
Walter Scott. Mel
Gibson.
Not Mel Gibson.
Russ Abbott.
The kind of stuff that gets flogged on tourist shops in Prince's Street in Edinburgh. How does that come about? How does it come to be this kind of moonshine end up coming to be marketed as part of Scotland in the way that it has done?
Well, it was just a way of selling it.
Canny advertising.
They sold it on Brand Scotland. There's that thing when George IV visited and he all got decked out in tartan.
Yeah.
And it was all stage managed by Walter Scott, this sort of, you know, and the sort of the cult of the Highland regiments, you know, being, you know, and the royal family going to Balmoral, Scottishness was sort of in.
But what about Irish whiskey? Because the Irish are also making lots of whiskey, aren't they?
Yes, Irish whiskey was different because it was generally more robustly flavoured, and it was very, very popular until, it was actually more popular than Scotch whiskey until the late 19th century.
So what happens?
It was pushed out, well, there's various reasons, but basically the new blended Scotch whiskies, these sort of light, fruity whiskey and soda whiskies, just pushed the Irish stuff out. And the Irish stuff was seen as rather old-fashioned. It wasn't as well marketed. It wasn't as smooth. Or, you know, this was how it was perceived. But at one point, Dublin was the whiskey capital of the world. Mm. There were four huge distilleries.
And talking of inferior whiskies, what's your perspective, Henry, on American whiskey?
Ooh, well, American whiskey is just very different because it's made out of American grains, like corn and, well, rye is not strictly American, but it grows very well in America. So I actually quite like American whiskey in a cocktail. So if I'm having a Manhattan or an old fashioned or something, you know, a nice bourbon or rye.
But you wouldn't drink it on its own?
I might, yeah. Well, you see, whiskey's my day job, so I have to keep...
Oh, God, you're just keeping in with the big whiskey.
Yeah, I have to keep
big bourbon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See, I'm sure when we turn the microphones off, Henry will cut loose and tell us what he really thinks of American drinks.
Well, but America has basically replaced Britain now. It has. As the arbiter of global drinks taste, I guess.
Well, is that the process then, you know, are we into a new phase? In other words, so much of what you've talked about today and what you talk about in your book, Empire of Booze, is about French, Italian, Spanish producers creating products for this big, rich British market and that defining the product. Is that now happening with the United States? So Or with China, yeah. So wine being produced and the style of wine or the style of spirits changing to match those new markets?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think with America, it's already happened. So I think
The cocktail bars, American bar,
bars. So all that sort of, you know, jazz age cocktails, the Savoy, all that sort of, that was all America. But also Americans did change how wine, especially how Bordeaux was made. So there was slightly going off topic. There's a very famous American wine critic called Robert Parker, who liked big wines.
Yeah.
And the producers in Bordeaux beefed up their wines or perhaps they were changing anyway because of the climate. But
there was also that, is it the Judgment of Paris, 1976, I think, American wines beat the French wines, and that seems great.
Exactly.
Transition from old.
But I think
world
all that's
new.
Already happened. So I think the American influence is already waning. And what comes after that?
Is it Chinese?
I think in some senses it is, because a lot of whiskey companies are making whiskies aimed at the Chinese market, but I'm not sure if it's about the flavour. It's more about the marketing and the packaging.
Or is it? I mean, is there a kind of alcohol equivalent of Global English, where the distinctiveness tends to be blurred because that way you can sell it to every conceivable market?
No, I think you're right. And everyone now makes whiskey, so you can get very nice whiskey that's made in Kent, made in Taiwan, made in Japan, made in China. And it's most of it has the Scotch template. So it will be made often by Scottish engineers using Scottish equipment and Scottish techniques, but in Taiwan. Or
so, Henry, before we finish, if you could recommend for listeners one drink that would take them back to the 17th or the 18th or the 19th century that they could use to see in the new year, what would you recommend that they get?
Oh, well, I just like a nice glass of port. Like we're having now, I know it's not...
any particular brand?
Well, we're drinking a Graham's 30-year-old at the moment, which is aged in wood. It's a tawny port.
So this is what, the taste of the 18th century?
This would have been, I don't know, perhaps not, perhaps later, perhaps taste of the 19th century.
Okay, well...
So 19th century Portugal, Tom.
See in...
Fado.
Yeah, see in the... political coups, revolutions.
Yeah.
What could be more fun? But no, but this would be drunk in a Victorian parlour, right? I mean, this is...
Yeah, you in England.
Yeah.
You could be drinking this and chatting to Anthony Trollope.
And then playing Blind Man's Buff.
Skittles, the immense mistress of the Duke of Cambridge.
Yes, and her skin-tight riding habit.
And General Gordon.
Yeah. What could be more fun than that?
That's my dream New Year combination.
Okay, well, Henry, thanks so much. Your book, Empire of Booze, is really, really brilliant. If you have any interest in drink or history or drink in history, absolutely unmissable. And you've got a new book coming out next year, is that right?
Next summer.
Vines in a Cold Climate, which is about English wine. And so that was my first ever job, was in an English winery. So I shall definitely be buying that. And we wish you all a very happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.